The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We just had the primary election for the mayor of New York City, and the winner, the very likely next mayor, is Democrat Eric Adams. He's the borough president of Brooklyn and a former state senator. But most importantly in this race, Adams was, for more than two decades, a police officer. And perhaps no debate in our society is more divisive than questions about policing. And here Adams holds a truly unique position. In his youth, he was beaten by police. When he joined the NYPD himself, he was a firebrand and an advocate for black officers. But now he's a sympathetic figure to the police department, a kind of law and order candidate. He rebuked other candidates who spoke of severely cutting police budgets, and he made the national spike in violent crime a big part of his rhetoric. Assuming that Eric Adams wins the general election, which is overwhelmingly likely, he'll take over a city that faces multiple overlapping crises that might daunt any politician. Mr. Adams, you there?
Yes, I am.
There you are. What you do is you go to the voice memo, you turn it on, you start a voice memo and start recording, and just hold the phone up to your ear as if we're talking on the phone.
Yep, now I'm recording. Now, am I through the interview? Am I holding it up like this?
Like we're on a phone call.
All right, that sucks.
Well, you know, life is hard.
And then you get elected mayor.
No, exactly. You're the one that wanted to have the second hardest office in the whole country. You can get out of it now if you want. I know one woman who'd be pleased. Now, it seems very recently where New York politics was being talked about as the center of, you know, the ascent of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the left in general. Along comes you, Eric Adams, and you're being celebrated on the day we speak in the most conservative column in the New York Times by Bret Stephens as something of a savior and a repudiation of the left. Do you see your likely ascent to Gracie Mansion and to City Hall as a repudiation of the left in New York City?
No, I don't. And I think one of the greatest tragedies of this campaign was the removal of my left philosophy. I am a progressive, and the 35 plus years of history shows that. You know, as a sergeant marching in front of Rockefeller Plaza only to go to Albany to reverse the draconian Rockefeller drug laws, marriage equality, my conference to get that vote on the floor 1 year to see who were not voting for it, and then later to push it through, gun violence. I testified in federal court. The judge mentioned me in her ruling on why she ruled against the police department. And so I believe that I am not a repudiation of the left. I believe I am the energy and spirit of New Yorkers. You know, darn it, they just want the lights to be on. They want their garbage picked up. They don't want their children not being educated. They're paying their taxes, and we should be doing our job with their tax dollars. And they heard me.
I was confused during the campaign, and I never really got a straight answer that I could glean and help me on this. All you say is true, and at the same time, you switch parties. You became a Republican for quite a long time. Why was that?
Yes, and it was out of real anger of the Democratic Party. You know, sometimes we view life based on our current state, but we need to go back. We were dealing with a city where we had 2,000 homicides a year. We saw a Democratic Party that created Many of the draconian laws that were put in place, we were incarcerating a large number of people for small amounts of crack cocaine instead of giving them the help they deserve. We had the crime bill that devastated many of our communities. And then we saw the Democratic Party in charge, but not dealing with real crime. And I was seeing that crime every day. And it was my protest of just saying I'm tired of this party ignoring the plight of people in the inner cities. And that was my protest and reflection. I could have done it a different ways. But, you know, as you move through life, you learn from your lessons. You don't relive them.
Are you saying you regret becoming a Republican for a period of time?
Yes, I do. There was no reason to do so. I could have found a better way to voice my outrage with the party. I could have resigned from the department and ran for office. And there were other things I could have done. But, you know, I made a lot of mistakes in life. Let me tell you something. I am perfectly imperfect. You know, I've made so many darn mistakes in my life that you have to laugh and say, how did this guy still get here? But I never stopped. I never stopped grinding, and I never stopped learning from those errors.
But you seem very plain-spoken and straightforward. What are your biggest mistakes?
Well, number one, I should have married my childhood sweetheart. She kicked me to the curb and went to Washington to marry someone else, you know. So, there are a lot of things that I did wrong. I wish I would have spent more time with my son. That was a real impactful moment for me. I spent so much time saving the lives of children that I was really afraid I was going to lose my son. And I'm just really amazed at how much he has developed as a child. And he said to me after the Eric Garner incident some years ago that, Dad, I understand why you were so determined. And our relationship is an amazing relationship, even when he was a child. But I wish I would have been around him more. And I put the movement in front of being the dad that I should have been during that time, in my opinion.
New Yorkers are beat. They're exhausted. This pandemic has been so brutal in the worst way. There's been lockdowns, death, curfews, changing mask rules, dealing with remote education for kids, no access to the arts. The list goes on and on and on. And you might soon be the leader whose job it is to restore New York to normal. What are you going to do, for example? You have 25% of New Yorkers who are still vaccine hesitant. One-third of hospital workers reportedly have not gotten their shots. One-third of hospital workers in New York. Why hasn't Mayor de Blasio tried to get that vaccination rate up? What mistakes has he made, and what are you going to do?
Well, you said something. You said two things that's very important. Number one, you said, how are we going to get back to normal? And there's a book called New York, New York, New York that I'm reading. And a woman went to Mayor Koch and she said, Mr. Mayor, can you make the city work again? And Mayor Koch looked at her and said, ma'am, this city never worked. And that's the reality. We call it normal. You know, you and I, we probably went to our great restaurants. We probably lived a great life. But it wasn't normal. Has never been normal.
Well, that's not very reassuring what you're telling me.
But it's being honest. We need to you know, be very honest that our city is dysfunctional, and it always has been for a large number of New Yorkers. You and I, we're insulated from that dysfunctionality. But, you know, let's be clear. I could take you throughout this city where the conditions have remained the same continuously throughout mayors after mayors. And so what I must do is stop the dysfunctionality of a city that has normalized being dysfunctional. And that is part of our inability to get the vaccination program the way it ought to be, to deal with the failure of testing. I told the mayor from the beginning of this COVID process that we should have opened the command center down at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, that we should have built out a system using real-time governance where we can see exactly where the testings were taking place, where we were actually seeing the hot spots so we could deploy things in real time. We must move our city to a real time. That's what we need to do with the vaccine. Every day we could easily use a simple Google Doc. When a person comes in, get vaccinated, put the information in the Google Doc, do a nightly mapping to look at the areas in real time that we're not reaching herd immunity and deploy the resources there and use all of our agencies in the process.
Will you tell hospital workers that they must be vaccinated?
No, I would not do that.
Why not?
What I will say to them...
But why wouldn't you do that?
First, let me tell you what I will do, and then we'll circle back to why I wouldn't do that. What I would tell them is that either you get vaccinated, and I'm going to strongly encourage that, or you have to get tested daily as you go into the hospital so we can know your status. I'm going to encourage vaccination. I am vaccinated. I'm going to encourage that. When I sit down in the groups of people that I have met with, there are real fears that people have. We're going to evolve to the place where COVID is going to be our norm. Let's be clear. COVID is a formidable opponent. It's going to be here a while. But there are real fears that people have because of the method on how we develop the vaccine. And there are real fears. And we need to get people off those fears and talk them off the cliff. We need to really use credible messengers to get people to embrace this and not feel as though we're doing something that is harmful to them. And I'm going to do that.
I'm talking with Eric Adams, the Democratic nominee and very likely next mayor of New York City. You've got a very complicated issue to face in essentially in your wheelhouse of on crime and police reform. How do you sell the police and their unions on the idea of reform? And how do you speak to the left, which is a very big constituency in this city, about the notion of defunding the police? This is not a cartoon issue. Nobody is saying strip the police of all resources on the one hand. So how do you deal with a very complex situation in which a pandemic was probably largely responsible for a spike in certain crime statistics? It's very serious. But a lot of public opinion has changed, and you seem to be saying no to defund the police, to even reform of the police that is pretty profound. You seem to be saying, wait a minute, I'm not up for that.
No, I'm not. I dedicated my life to police reform. You know, but what many people don't know, when I was 15 years old and the police assaulted me, they don't know that around that same time, I lost a good friend to gun violence. The crack wars were taking place. And so I was traumatized by police, and I was traumatized by the gang drug violence. And so I come in with this dual emotion that the prerequisite to prosperity is public safety and justice, and we could have both. And I'm going to reach out to my unions, and I'm going to reach out, my law enforcement unions, that is. I'm going to reach out to the credible messengers, crisis management teams, my clergy groups, and everyday New Yorkers. And I'm going to tell them, let's turn the page. We need each other. The streets of our city, those streets will be controlled by the good guys or bad guys. And right now, the bad guys are winning. And it is harmful to police officers, and it's harmful to everyday people.
You say the bad guys are winning. I hear rhetoric like that sometimes on right-wing Twitter and Fox, and as if somehow uniformly the streets of New York have gone from placid to berserk. There's no doubt there's been spike in some crime statistics, without a doubt, and I don't underestimate that and the danger of that. But isn't that largely the result of the effect of the pandemic and all that has wrought? You want to bring back hugely controversial, now disbanded anti-crime unit of the New York Police Department. But that was notorious in its time for harassment and worse, wasn't it? Aren't you wary of bringing back Giuliani-era methods that led us to a bad place in this city?
No, I'm not. And first, let's look at anti-crime never went away. And Giuliani didn't bring anti-crime. Anti-crime plainclothes officers, they have been in place as long as policing has been in place. You know, they abused it. And abuse of a tool is the worst thing you can do. And that's the same thing with stop, question, and frisk. We went to stop and frisk. We took a tool and we said, instead of using it what you're supposed to use it for, if someone is, you believe someone's committed a crime, we use it as a quota system. That's what I fought against and testified against. We basically said, go into a community based on ethnicity and crime level and stop everyone you see. That's an abuse of a tool. Eric Adams is mayor. My police commissioner is going to know how to use tools the way they're supposed to be used legally and not abuse those tools. And so, no, we don't have a city that's back to 2,000 homicides a year. But perception is reality. If we continue to see three-year-olds shot in Times Square or Asian members of our city attacked, it's going to hurt tourism, a multi-billion dollar industry. No one is going to return here. We're going to lose our high-income earners who are fleeing because they don't feel safe. Remember, only 65,000 people pay 51% of our income taxes. That allows us to have teachers, sanitation employees, police. We can't lose our high-income earners. And so the perception of fear is hurting our economy.
So your fear is that wealthy people in New York City are going to run off to Palm Beach and wherever, and we're going to lose so much tax revenue that city services across the board are going to deteriorate.
I fear that, and I fear large corporations stating, I am not staying in this city, like they're saying to parts of San Francisco, when you see tent cities and you see a total disorder in San Francisco, large corporations are leaving the city. And what's happening at Washington Square Park? I was there the other day with my son. Someone was injecting themselves with heroin right inside the park. You can't run cities the way we're running this city. And I'm fearful that if we lose our corporations, our high income earners, we're not going to be able to employ middle class New Yorkers, that they're going to be able to enjoy the quality of life they deserve.
Mr. Adams, you know better than anyone that despite Brown versus the Board of Education and the many decades that followed, New York City still has a public school system that is astonishingly segregated. And the question is what to do about it.
That's a great question. We're a segregated city. You know, our schools, they are a reflection of how we're segregated as a city. We try to act like we're hip and cool and integrated. Like, heck, we are. Are you kidding me? We live in these pockets. And people, they talk about it, let's all live together. But, you know, try to build affordable housing on someone's block. And they say, wait a minute, we don't want these people here. We need to stop it.
But what are you prepared to do to change that? When it comes to the school system, do you think it shouldn't be changed?
No, it should be changed. You know, the quality of an education is not only being academically smart, but being emotionally intelligent. And our children must develop their full personhood. And part of that is understanding and appreciating diversity. That is our secret weapon. Number one, I am a believer we have to upzone in affluent communities. We have had it backwards for so long. We've upzoned in poor communities, move rich people in and displace poorer people. No, let's upzone in affluent communities, move poorer people in and allow them to diversify the schools in the process, because now you live in that district. Allow them access to healthy food, access to good health care, where you could have a holistic approach. And then let's make sure we do what we did in Park Slope.
So you just got finished saying to me you're worried about the tiny proportion of rich people running out of New York City. If poor people start somehow, I don't know how they're going to do it, move into Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue, don't you think that's going to hasten the departure of people on Fifth Avenue to Palm Beach?
And no, I do not. When I speak to my affluent New Yorkers and sit down, engage real healthy conversations of having a real affordable housing program in their communities, no, we're not talking about shelters. We're not talking about building NYCHA on Park and 53rd Street. We're talking about mixed income, affordable units where people can come and desegregate their communities. And a lot of my affluent New Yorkers enjoy knowing that their children are growing up in a diverse, multicultural environment. And I think we give New Yorkers a bad, really marked by thinking they don't. I think it's possible. We have to diversify our schools. We're doing a disservice to our children.
So you live in Bed-Stuy, which is a big neighborhood in Brooklyn, for those who live out of town, as we say in New York. Bed-Stuy traditionally for decades has been a mainly black neighborhood in Brooklyn, big neighborhood, and it's increasingly gentrified. And how do you feel about that? How do you feel about the gentrification of your own neighborhood?
Well, first, I love diversity. And we need to really understand gentrification is not an ethnicity. It's a mindset. And when you come into a community, no matter what your ethnicity may be, and you don't talk to the people who are there, You don't patronize the stores, the shops. You basically attempt to displace long-term good practices. That's gentrification. But if you come into a community with that old-time feeling that you come with a cake, that you're now a new neighbor, if you engage in, if you're part of the school, if you involve, that's a wonderful thing. I want my son to know. I look at his friends and I see the different ethnic groups and how they engage with each other. That's an amazing, beautiful feeling. But the energy of coming into a community and believing that you are now taking over and you're going to use the police and other agencies as your tools to go after their long-term residents there and displace them, that's wrong. That can't happen, and we cannot allow it to happen.
One of the most complicated, perhaps the most complicated relationship you're going to have to negotiate as mayor, and this has always been the case in New York, is with the governor. Governors and mayors get along like cats and dogs. You know it, and I know it. The relationships have always been, at best, horrible. Horrible. De Blasio and Cuomo can barely say a civil word to each other. Now, as you well know, Governor Cuomo is being investigated for reports of sexual harassment. And you were not one of those who joined the call for Cuomo to resign. Why not?
Because it's a process. What's great about this amazing country we're in is something called due process. And particularly as a black man, history has so many examples of where people have just basically stated, we're going to skip over the due process part. We have an investigation taking place. The attorney general is extremely competent. Let her do her job. She did interview him as well as the victims that stated they were victimized. Let's let the process take its course.
And did the accusations trouble you?
Yes, they did. They were extremely troubling. I believe that no one should be the victim of any over-aggressive or any intrusive actions. I was extremely troubled to hear them, but I do respect the process, and we need to allow the process to take its course.
Mr. Adams, a final question. Who's the best mayor this city has ever had?
Oh, that's a great question. I will have to mix up a few. I patterned myself after Dinkins, Bloomberg, and LaGuardia. A blue-collar guy, you know, just an everyday guy, blue-collar guy, nothing fancy. There's nothing fancy about me, you know.
Wait, you're not saying Michael Bloomberg is a blue-collar guy.
Bloomberg was a good, smart person that knew how to use data. But when you pattern yourself on the ground, I think that's the energy and spirit of a person, a hardworking New Yorker. The life I live is a life that New Yorkers are living right now, from being a dishwasher, going to school at night, paying my way through college, working hard, having a learning disability, overcoming that, being arrested, but going from saying, woe is me to why not me. That's what people picked up when I ran for mayor. They said, this is one of us. This is just an ordinary guy that wants to do something for ordinary people in this city.
Mr. Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Eric Adams is the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, and he faces Republican Curtis Sliwa in the November general election. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. As the 2024 election draws near, It's more important than ever to understand exactly what's happening in American politics. The New Yorker offers definitive reporting and analysis by some of the best writers and political thinkers watching the campaign. Commentators and reporters, including Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, Jelani Cobb, Masha Gessen, Evan Osnos, Ben Wallace Wells, and many more are providing incisive analysis that you don't want to miss. Subscribers get unlimited access to all of it. And we're offering a deal just for podcast listeners, 15% off a yearly digital subscription. Visit newyorker.com and use the code POD15. That's POD15 for 15% off a digital subscription to The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Lately, the stories we're reading about international espionage are kind of like something from Cold War spy novels. Nerve agents deployed against a Russian dissident. A so-called Havana syndrome, which we've reported in The New Yorker. Apparently some kind of microwave weapon that's used on American diplomats who, after the attacks, have showed signs of brain damage. Now there's this. U.S. officials have indicted four Iranian nationals of planning an extraordinary plot on U.S. soil. It targeted an American born in Iran named Masih Alinejad, a journalist and an activist. She's quite critical of the Iranian regime, particularly of the requirement that women wear the hijab. According to a recently unsealed indictment, the plotters researched kidnapping Alinejad in Brooklyn, evacuating her by speedboat, taking a sea route to Venezuela, and from there, flying her to Iran, presumably to be put on trial, or much worse. When the FBI caught wind of the scheme, they put her and her husband in a series of safe houses where they stayed for months. Masih Alinejad and her husband, Kambiz Farouhar, join me now. Masih, the last few months must have been very stressful and incredibly strange. Now that this indictment has been unsealed, do you feel that you're on the other side of this experience, or do you feel safe from being kidnapped or being harmed in any way?
To be honest, the word safe is too luxury for us Iranians. Because, yeah, I am under FBI's protection, but, you know, every single word that I say here to you, I don't know what's going to happen to my brother in prison. I don't know what's going to happen to my family inside Iran. It is stressful, it is scary, but to be honest, right now, they send someone here in America to kidnap me. So it shows you that they're scared of me as well.
Kambiz, take me through the experience of the FBI's reaching out to you, I believe, in September to warn you.
Well, the initial call came as a surprise for us. There were repeated phone calls, and they sent a car, an unmarked car, to pick us up, take us to a headquarters at the New York. And they said, someone in America is following you, taking videos of you, taking photographs of everything you're doing and sending it to Ministry of Intelligence in Iran. And our reaction was that, why don't you do something about it? And it was like, that's what we're trying to do.
Now, when you were given the details of the plot, the whole business of spiriting you onto a speedboat and taking you to Venezuela and then flying you from Venezuela somehow to Iran, it sounds like the worst spy novel we've ever read. How did you react to it initially?
Look, this is exactly what happened to Ruhollah Zam. Ruhollah was a journalist like me. They tricked him from France to Iraq, and they kidnapped him from Iraq. Then they executed him. And I was like, oh my God, that was going to happen to me. So you see, for us, the scary movie is the reality.
Why is the Islamic Republic so interested in what you've said in your writing? You've written very strongly against the laws requiring women to wear the hijab.
I think it's very difficult for Westerners to understand what Masih has touched on with her campaign against compulsory hijab, because they said this is a fashion item, the compulsory hijab. You know, people in America wear hijab. What's the big deal? For Iran, hijab is like the Berlin Wall was to the Soviet system. It's a symbol of the Islamic Republic. And what Mass is doing, challenging, saying that this is not a choice for us. It's absolute. And Iranian women are coming out and saying, yes, I hate this hijab. And so the narrative of the Islamic Republic was that Iranian women are choosing to wear hijab, and Mass is challenging that narrative. So if the hijab is falls down, the Islamic Republic itself is undermined. And this is the red line for the Islamic Republic. For them, it's a life or death situation.
Masi, maybe we should be clear on how you're reaching an Iranian audience.
Look, my weapon is my social media. The Iranian government, they have all the official media. They have newspapers. They have money, power, prison. I have my Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and altogether 7 million followers. So that scares them. So I just ask people inside Iran, talk to me. Be your own storytellers. You don't need anyone to come and save you. Be your own savior. That's all I do. And I receive videos of mothers whose children got killed in Iran protest. They don't have any media inside Iran. They send a video to me while going to the same street that their children got shot in the head. And that scares the government because they don't want people to be fearless and to speak up. The head of the Revolutionary Court came out on TV, said that if anyone sent videos to Mahsa Ahmadinejad, will be charged up to 10 years prison. Isn't that stupid in 21st century?
Now, Masi, I know that you spoke with Secretary of State Blinken last week. How do you feel the Biden administration has responded to your situation?
To be honest, part of the Biden's administration did a great job, the Justice Department, by stopping the plot. That was amazing. But I have to be honest, I'm disappointed because this is a threat to Americans on their own soil. Imagine it was not me. It was President Biden's son. Would he go after them and say, okay, let's talk about nuclear deal? No. The first thing he would ask was, release my son. Now they arrested my brother. American citizen is in prison. British citizen is in prison. You know, so many European citizens are in prison. They're being used like bargaining chip for nuclear deal. I want Biden's administration is to stop negotiation, first ask for the release of all those innocent political prisoners.
When you say stop negotiations, you're referring to the negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear accords?
Yeah, that's it. Because look, when you negotiate with the regime without considering the human rights violation, basically you're empowering such a dictatorship to put more pressure on people.
But this is a very old dilemma, watching administrations of all kinds balancing human rights questions with nuclear arms questions. When the United States was negotiating with the Soviet Union back in the day, the Soviet Union had political prisoners in camps all over the Soviet Union. And at the same time, the Nixon administration, the Carter administration, the Ford administration, all negotiated with the Soviet Union on questions of nuclear arms, even while discussing human rights questions. Is there some way in your mind that these can be balanced in terms of international diplomacy, or do you think that's a farce?
I think after the Obama administration and now with Biden administration, they have isolated Iran into different boxes. And I think we want to discuss with box of nuclear, and that's all we're going to talk about. And once we deal with nuclear, we can get to other areas. The issue is that if one, the human rights issue, the terrorism issue of Iran, it gets buried under the fact that they want to reach a deal on nuclear. Whereas I think it's a much larger issue. The fact that you're negotiating with Iran at the same time that Iranians are plotting a campaign inside the U.S., well, how much of a good relationship is that? How can you trust that good faith negotiation?
Masi, I just want to make clear to listeners that your sister was forced to go on Iranian television to denounce you. Am I correct? And your brother
yes, you
was
are.
Sent to prison. This must add to the pressure immeasurably.
I don't want to cry because I don't want to see me broken. But it's not easy. Imagine you sitting here in America and you see your sister 17 minutes on Iranian state TV denouncing you, disowning you. My brother risked his life. He's in prison right now. Because when the regime had a plan to kidnap me, from Turkey, he was the one, he called me and he said, Mahsa, If mom and dad call you and say, come to Turkey, we want to visit you, we want to hug you, don't. Because the intelligence service is behind them. So we loved each other, you know. My mom was interrogated for 2 hours. And now she's stopped sharing her love with me. Why? I'm not a criminal. I'm just a journalist, an activist. I'm just giving voice to voiceless people. I'm not doing anything wrong. And sometimes I cannot even breathe when I think about them. But I have to choose my path. Because of my own family keeps silent, I have a bigger family. The women inside Iran who's sending me videos, although they know that they're going to face 10 years prison, the mothers of those people who got killed in Iran protests keep sending me videos. I have to make a decision. And if I keep silent, I'm going to betray my own people. If I keep silent, I'm going to send a signal to the regime, okay, threatening activists and journalists work. So go after another one. And every day I tell myself that they did everything to stop me. They did everything to make me feel miserable. But I'm going to make them feel miserable. I'm going to make my oppressors feel miserable. I'm not going to give up.
Kambiz, what did the FBI tell you in terms of moving forward and your own safety?
Well, they said if it was them, they would move our house. We would change our location, maybe even change the city. And they felt we were safe. But, you know, as long as the Islamic Republic is in power, there's a bullseye on Massey's back. Essentially, we are targets. You know, when this is what's happening, I got the book by Salman Rushdie, you know, by his experiences as to living, going to being under threat of a fatwa. Well, we didn't get a fatwa, but...
I got the fatwa.
Massey has fatwas of her own.
Yeah, no, I got a fatwa. And even the cleric made a video and said that even in New York, we're going to throw acid on your face. There's so many threats. I didn't take them serious. This time, because FBI came to us, we took it serious.
Massey and Kambiz, what is your plan going forward now? How do you plan to live your life after being made aware that there was such a terrifying plot aimed against you?
Keep going.
We're going to double our efforts in our fight against the Islamic Republic.
I became more determined. I became more powerful, you know. Of course it is scary, but I feel more powerful that I am not going to give up and I'm going to be stronger, louder, condemning this terrorist regime. And this is not about me. This is about all Americans. They should feel safe in their homeland. But just because of the Islamic Republic, they want me to look over my shoulder? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to live in fear. That's it.
Massey and Kambiz, I can't be more grateful to you. I really appreciate your time. I wish you the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Massey Alinejad is a journalist for Voice of America, and her 2018 book is called The Wind in My Hair. Kambiz Furuhar was a journalist for Bloomberg, and he's a strategist for a financial services firm in London. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. We'll be right back.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Pegasus is everything the digital privacy advocates have been warning us about for years. Pegasus is spyware, and it allows the user to access all the contents of a target's phone. That software is the creation of an Israeli firm called NSO, which claims that its creation was only licensed for use by governments, for law enforcement, and for the battle against terrorism. But an investigative effort led by a nonprofit called Forbidden Stories, and including more than a dozen news organizations, asserts something far more sinister. According to this week's reports, Pegasus has been used to target journalists, human rights activists, political opponents, and many others whom governments consider perhaps inconvenient. In India, the journalist and scholar Siddharth Varadarajan was one such target of Pegasus. He's a frequent critic of India's ruling party. Varadarajan spoke last week with staff writer Isaac Chotiner.
You have a very unique perspective on this story because you are both sort of the micro and macro involved. Your news organization, The Wire, is one of the 17 organizations working on this Pegasus project. And you yourself may have had your phone tapped. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this story, both as an editor and as a subject?
So sometime in the middle of March, Forbidden Stories, which is the French organization which is coordinating this collaborative project, got in touch with me and with my colleague and co-founding editor at The Wire, M.K. Venu, to inform us that they had reasons to believe that both of our phones had been infected with spyware. And they wanted to see if we would be willing to have our phones forensically examined for the presence of Pegasus. We asked what this involves and how complicated is the process, because neither of us are particularly tech savvy. And then we decided, okay, we'll go ahead. And Forbidden Stories got back with the bad news, fully compromised, fully infected with Pegasus. That's when they explained a little bit about the project and asked whether The Wire would be willing to be part of an international consortium that was going to investigate and report on the full extent to which phones around the world might have been targeted with this horrible spyware. And we decided to jump in.
So Forbidden Stories presents everyone in the consortium with a list of 50,000 numbers. What is that list exactly, and how did you connect it later on to specific names and people in India?
So the list of 50,000 numbers was accessed by Forbidden Stories. And essentially, Forbidden Stories has established that this is a list of numbers selected as potential targets for surveillance by clients of the NSO group.
This is NSO group, the Israeli technology firm that appears to be selling the technology to these different governments.
Now, the NSO group strenuously denies having anything to do with this list. But they also conceded in their letter that they have a strong belief that this list of numbers is being used by clients of NSO. In other words, the fact that this list emerges from clients of NSO, to my mind, is not in dispute. What's in dispute is what exactly do the clients of NSO have in mind when they put a number on the list, right? What we had to work with was simply a list of numbers. And to then try to identify whom these numbers belong to was not quite a needle in a haystack kind of job, but it was difficult. We were able to populate some names based on people that we knew who were on our phone book, and it was a bit alarming to discover that people that we knew were also on this list of potential spyware victims. We were able to verify the identity of 300 of those numbers on this among the Indian numbers. Which is a pretty decent number. It's quite a decent proportion.
And among those 300 numbers, I understand the consortium was able to actually do forensic analysis on a much smaller number of those Indian phones, and 10 of them showed signs of being infected by Pegasus. So that raises the question, maybe you can tell us more about how exactly Pegasus works.
Pegasus essentially allows the operator of the spyware to take remote control over your phone. So nothing that you do on your smartphone once it's infected is secure. All your conversations through Signal or WhatsApp are compromised. Pegasus also allows the remote operator to take control of your microphone, your camera, see any files that you've stored in your phone. So it's essentially a mirror to the contents of your phone. And, you know, if you have Pegasus, then you can forget about having any privacy when you use your phone.
Can you talk a little bit about the climate for journalism in India? Prime Minister Modi was elected in 2014. He was reelected in 2019. And there's been concern about declining press freedom in the country since that time, especially over the last few years. How do you understand the climate about press freedom? And can you talk about what's changed in your reporting over the past several years?
The media freedom climate in India is abysmal right now. And I'm choosing my words very carefully. You know, there's enormous pressure on journalists, on editors, on media organizations to not be critical, to not cover certain kinds of stories, to not offer certain kinds of perspectives. So there is a lot of self-censorship that goes on. We have a disturbing trend. We always had a problem in India of government officials or corporates using slap suits or defamation cases to intimidate and to turn a media organization away from covering a certain story. That was the first form of pressure put on the wire. You know, multiple defamation suits filed against us. These are all frivolous cases, but they consume time and money. What's been happening over the last 2 or 3 years is a growing tendency for the police in different parts of India to actually file criminal cases now in response to a report that they don't like. And this is a new trend, and it's very, very harmful. And it's had a chilling effect on media coverage, for sure.
We've been talking a lot about journalists, but there were also dissidents. There were NGO workers, other people who were opponents of the government in some way or seen as opponents of the government were part of this list. There was also Rahul Gandhi, who's one of the leaders of the Congress Party, which is still, even though much diminished, the main opposition party to Modi's BJP in India. Was that surprising to you to see Rahul Gandhi on this list? And can you talk a little bit about the political meaning of what we've seen?
You know, there's been a long-standing tradition in India of the government using its intelligence agencies to gather political intelligence. One assumes that they have always kept an eye on what the opposition is doing, what critics are doing. But what the use of Pegasus does or involves is hacking into somebody's smartphone, which is actually a criminal offense under the Indian Information Technology Act. And there's no exception for law enforcement. So it was a bit surprising for us to come face to face with the brazen use of an illegal means of surveillance in such a kind of instrumental fashion, right? So you have somebody like Prashant Kishore. Kishore is India's premier political strategist, and he's been advising opposition parties in state elections. And he played a key role recently in the West Bengal state elections, a very, very important state election that was held in March and April this year. And Kishore, as it emerged when we did a forensic examination of his phone, Prashant Kishore's phone turned out to be compromised, fully infected with Pegasus. And Pegasus activity on his phone was happening right in the midst of the West Bengal election. The key political advisor to Narendra Modi's opponent in that state had been hit with Pegasus. You know, this is pretty damning because we now have, you know, conclusive proof that Pegasus is being used in an election. And to my mind, that's as close to a kind of Watergate moment in India as you're ever going to get.
Can you just explain sort of briefly how we are sure or how you can be sure that it's the Indian government that is deploying Pegasus?
Because they are the only ones who can use Pegasus. We have NSO, the company which sells Pegasus, saying repeatedly that we only sell to governments. So if NSO sells Pegasus only to governments, and Pegasus has been found in the phone of political opponents of Narendra Modi during an election, it's a reasonable surmise that the government is the one that's doing it.
You referred to this earlier as a potential Watergate moment. Most people know that Watergate ended with the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Do you have any hope, or even if you're not hoping one way or the other, do you have any sense that Prime Minister Modi could face some, or his government could face some sort of legal reckoning around Pegasus issues?
So it's really not clear to me today what the outcome of our expose is going to be. I mean, the opposition is up in arms, and I think the scale of surveillance that our project has exposed, I think, will be alarming to ordinary people. I mean, there's no question of an equivalent of Nixon resigning. Mr. Modi will serve out his full term for sure. I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of the reactions and statements that have come from the highest levels of government over the last 2 days. The Home Minister of India, who's the second most powerful guy, has declared that this project, which involves 17 media organizations around the world, and is talking about surveillance, not just in India, but in Mexico. Today, we've broken the story of Macron being put on the list. But the government of India believes that this entire project is a conspiracy against India and against the Modi government. They are likely to double down on their authoritarian practices and divisive politics. So there is this danger that in dealing with the crisis that they perceive has emerged, they will actually start doing things that are going to make the situation in the country much worse.
Siddharth, to you and anyone else at the government who may be listening, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Isaac Chotiner is a staff writer, principal contributor to Q&A at NewYorker.com, and he spoke with Siddharth Varadarajan in India. The Indian government maintains that any surveillance it conducts is according to its laws and due process. And NSO, the maker of Pegasus, insists that the 50,000 phone numbers associated with the spyware is not at all a target list. So far, there is no evidence that agencies in the United States have used Pegasus. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.